Amen. Have a seat. How are we doing today? Fantastic. I know it's Easter because I see more people with blazers on, so that's always good. Welcome to Crossroads Bible Church. My name is Charlie. I work here. So it is Easter today, and a couple things. We're going to be in John chapter 20. If you have a Bible, you can go there. But essentially what we're talking about this morning is the idea that our perceptions really inform our reality and then lead to our actions, right? So what we believe, where we start with any kind of information or data or event, what we believe about that, our perception about it informs what we believe to be true, and then we interpret that and act, yeah? And that's true in just about all aspects of our lives. And I could talk about politics and bring it up, but we have guests today, so I'm gonna be nice, right? So let me talk about something that happens in my life. I'm married. We've been married for 4 years, and my wife is 5 months pregnant, and I have a girl coming on August 12th, and that's when you say that is just adorable, because it is. Thanks. I'm doing most of the work. Anyway, so the kid comes on August 12th, and people keep asking us, are you guys excited? We have this app. I don't know if you know it. It's called The Bump, and it's an app for parents, and each Sunday morning, I get an email that likens my child to a fruit and or vegetable. So it's based on the size of the kid. And so today I got reminded or told that my kid this week is an endive, right? So that's a perfect example of I will always love my kid, but for the next week, maybe not like them. So we've been talking about what it looks like to be a parent, and people keep asking us, are you guys excited? And we mostly reply with, no, we're terrified, you know? Because here's the deal, when you're first-time parents, when that's the perspective I come from, things aren't exciting as they are scary. An example this week, because we have no idea what's going on or if it's normal. Everything is not normal. We haven't done this before. This week, my wife was driving home one night, and she called me, and she said, hey, you know, my stomach hurts. Is this okay? Is this normal? And I said, I have no idea and no way to know about that, but I appreciate you asking my opinion here. And she said, it just really hurts. It hurts to sit. It kind of hurts to breathe. Is everything okay? And instead of knowing it was okay, we're just scared. You know, so she gets home and Googles things. That's a terrible idea, everybody. And she Googles things, and we talk to some friends, and we realize that everything's just fine, but, you know, there's a kid inside her that is pushing her body outward, so that hurts sometimes. Meanwhile, fast forward, I was talking with a friend of mine the next morning about it, who's a pediatric nurse, and she has an 18-month-old, and I asked, is this normal? And she said, yes, and she said, but it only gets way worse. And I said, thanks. And she said, literally, it gets worse in all the ways. The pain gets worse, and then, about in a week or so, you're going to start to feel this kid kicking around, and that's going to be exciting. But then fast forward to month 7 and 8, and you're going to have about a 2 or 3 hour window where you don't feel the kid kicking around, and then you're going to get really scared. She said when she was pregnant with her kid, if it was 3 hours and she hadn't felt the kid move, she starts freaking out, right? Like, is it still in there? She's like punching her stomach, trying to wake the baby up. And that's the perspective of a first-time parent. I was talking to a friend of mine last night who has 2 kids, and she said the difference was I did that the first time. The second time, when my kid didn't kick me for 3 hours, I just said, thank God, you know? This kid is leaving me alone. It completely changes our perspective, completely changes our reality, which then changes how we act. And that's really what's going on in all of the scriptures of Jesus. So we've been in this series called Dust. And it's because Jesus is a rabbi, and he has 12 people that follow him, and sometimes many, many more. And in the first century world, when you learned about religion, you would follow the rabbi around, and there was a blessing they would say over disciples, and it would go like this. It said, may the dust of your rabbi ever be on you. And what that meant was that you follow your teacher, your rabbi, so closely everywhere he walks, that as he kicks up dust from his shoes, it covers you. And so we've been looking at the following of Jesus over the last 12 weeks. And what we've seen is a dynamic shift in the perspective of the disciples when it comes to Jesus. When we first started, most of them didn't know whether they could trust Jesus or not. He'd say things like, come and follow me. And one of them said, yeah, but I know you. Like, I know you're not somebody to be followed because I kind of grew up with you, you know? I saw you go through the awkward teenage years and, you know, nothing special, yeah? And so what we see, though, as Jesus started teaching more and more and started doing miracle after miracle after miracle, is these 12 guys, and then sometimes many, many more, change their perspective from he's a cousin or a brother or an acquaintance or a friend to, I mean, he's a really great teacher. worth following. Two, and then he started healing people, and they said, man, he's a prophet. And then there's this one story in Mark chapter 4, it's one of my favorites, when they're on a boat, and they're afraid they're going to die, and the wind and the waves are crashing all around them. And these are experienced fishermen that think they're going to die, and Jesus is sleeping. And they wake him up, and Jesus speaks, and the water just stops. And at that moment, they kind of pushed out of, oh, he's a teacher, and he's a friend, and he's a prophet, too. Only God controls these things. And from then on out, we see the disciples' perspective of Jesus shift from he's more than all those things, and maybe he's God. So as they shifted their perspective of how they thought about Jesus, their trust increased. Their courage went up. The pursuit of the disciples, the study of the disciples and following Jesus is just simply a study in how they grew in their understanding of who he was. And so today in John chapter 20, we're looking at the perspective of a woman called Mary who followed Jesus. And what we're going to find today, my point today, is at its very base, the resurrection changes our perspective in a couple ways. And we want to find out how. So go to John chapter 20. I'm going to read through it and stop along the way and talk about it a little bit. So we find this woman, Mary Magdalene. I'm going to start in verse 1 and then skip down in verse 10 because their story picks back up. It says in verse 1, now very early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb and saw that the stone had been moved away from the entrance. So at the very first, what we see is Mary Magdalene there before anyone else, before it was even sunny outside. And what we have to know about Mary is that she loved Jesus a lot. So she was there at the cross when he died. She stood and sat and wept next to it. And then they put him into the tomb, and then she is the first one there the next morning before the sun even came up. That's how much she values her relationship with Jesus. And we keep seeing it. Go to verse 10. The disciples went back to their homes, but Mary stood outside the tomb weeping. So what we see with Mary is she's visibly, noticeably distraught that Jesus is gone. And why that is, if you know anything about Mary, Mary's a woman who has a past. And what Jesus did was Jesus came along and promised her a better future. Jesus came along and said, hey, your past doesn't define you. I love you anyway. Jesus came along and said, even though your past doesn't merit much hope, there is hope for you. Jesus came along and said, you can start new. And Mary needed that message, like most of us need that message too. And so when she saw Jesus die, all that went away. All of that hope, all of that identity, all of that wishing that she's not defined by who she was anymore went away. And she's distraught. And so she loved Jesus, she followed Jesus, she knew Jesus, she's there in the morning, and she's outside the tomb weeping. And she finds some angels. Look at verse 11 and 12. As she wept, she bent down and looked into the tomb, and she saw two angels in white sitting where Jesus' body had been laying. They looked, one at the head and the other at the feet. They said to her, why are you weeping? Mary said, they've taken my Lord away, and I don't know where they put him. So a couple things happening here. The body was a big deal in Jewish customs, in funeral customs. So the ways that funeral worked in the first century Jewish world is everybody would stop down for 7 days and mourn. There'd be a 7-day period of lament. And usually people from the community and the city and the extended family would visit the parents or the family of the person that had died. And for 7 days, they'd just sit with them and weep. And they'd come back and forth from the house to the tomb to the house to the tomb, weeping along the way. After 7 days, everything kind of went back to normal as it could for the community. But the family kept weeping. The family kept weeping for up to a year. I had a professor in college, and his wife of a long time died when I was there. He was a theology professor, and I remember I'd never seen anything like this, but everybody mourned his wife's death, and you kind of get back into the rhythms of school, and you kind of forget because your life is semi-normal. But for a year, he wore black and only black every day, all day, because he was weeping his wife's death. That's what the family did here. And after a year, they'd go back to the tomb, and they'd collect the bones of the person that had fallen away, that died, and they would have a second service. And they'd collect the bones and usually put them with family members because they believed in resurrection, and resurrection with family. And so when Mary comes to the tomb and sees that his body is gone, it makes sadness upon sadness upon sadness. It's not just that he died, but now I don't even know where his body is. How can I properly mourn and show honor to my family and friend who's dead? sadness upon sadness upon sadness. And so she sees the angels. And at this point, she's not just like weeping like one or two tears. This is ugly cry. You know what I'm talking about? This is ugly cry, like I've lost, like snot probably, I've lost. And she looks, and you know it's an ugly cry because she looks at angels and she doesn't even pick up on that fact. She's like, I don't know what's happening, but two men are there where Jesus is. And they have the audacity to look at Mary. I love this line. They look at Mary. They're sitting where her friend that had died should have been buried. And they're like, hey, why are you crying? You know? It's one of those questions that's supposed to elicit a response from Mary that pushes her to think hard about something. Yeah? But it's kind of like salt in the wound. This week, we saw Steve hobble on up here. And he had surgery, oh, I don't know, 2 months ago. He's a slow recoverer. And for a while, he was on this like scooter thing. And look, here's the deal. You would think that as a church staff, as family, as friends, we would show compassion. We saw it as weakness. And so literally, we would do some mocking, just gently and lightly. This week, though, he's from the Midwest, so his two favorite meals are meatloaf and carrot cake. Yep, don't know why, but he thinks they're both very good for some reason. And so he had somebody made a carrot cake for the office this week, and we have this space upstairs where they just put food to make us fatter. And you have to walk by it to go anywhere. It's awful, but it's fantastic. And there was this one piece of carrot cake. And Steve had set it aside, put it on a separate plate with like this huge glass dome over the top, and he'd put a post-it note that said, Steve's carrot cake, don't eat, exclamation points, right? And this dude's infirm. You'd think that as a loving staff member, I'd say, Steve, you let me know when you want me to bring that to your office, big guy. You know, I just want to serve you. I didn't. I hit it. I hit it because that was just for my joy. And so I knew it was happening because Steve, I could hear him like crutching down the hallway, you know, like crutchy and newsies. I'm hearing him crutching down the hallway and I was like, it's beginning. And I hear him, he gets to this table and he stops. And if you've never heard it before, Steve sounds just like Woody from Toy Story. You can't unhear it, by the way. So he exclaims like he always does, what? And I'm in the conference room at the end of the hall smiling. And he goes, what happened to my carrot cake? And who took my carrot cake? And I'm hearing this. And then for some reason, he thought I had something to do with it. So he crutches down, right, to the conference room. And he looks in the room. And I said, Steve, you missing something, buddy? And he said, where's my carrot cake? I said, did you lose some carrot cake? Right? And this went on for a couple minutes as I continued to smile. And then I didn't tell him where it was. So I think that this is kind of what's happening with the angels here. We knew it, I knew it, they knew it. What I'm trying to get Steve to do was look around for his carrot cake. In every moment, I think that question made it darker and worse and sadder for Mary. She's distraught. Not just her friend, but her hope had died. Now the body's gone, she can't bury him the right way. And these angels look at her and they say, why are you weeping? It just makes matters worse. So I can see the weeping progressing more and more and more. And then if you look at verse 14, it says, when she said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but she didn't know who he was. I have to stop down for just a sec. There are things in the Bible that I just love about how they tell the story, and this is one of them. So you got to think that, and I play this game a lot, if I was God, what would I do? You know, I talk about it at Christmas. If I was God, how would I show my presence as a baby to the world? It involved fog machines and some kind of, you know, laser light show. Basically a Justin Timberlake concert. So I play this game now. If I had died and I had beaten death, I would absolutely let people know that I was back, you know? It'd be some crowded place in the middle of somewhere. There'd be some cloud action fog machine symbolizing the Holy Spirit. You know, all of that goodness would be around me. And I'd be like, guys, you didn't do a good enough job. Like, it would be a known commodity. Jesus first appears. The first time he comes back, the first people he shows himself to are women. Three women, actually. This is one of them. And that is significant for a couple reasons. One, in the first century world, women weren't treated as equals. They were treated as property more than they were people. Women were seen as expendable in a lot of ways. Men held all the power. Women couldn't even put testimony forward in court because they weren't seen as trustworthy or credible. These are the people that Jesus appeared to first. And I can't help but love the fact that what I think he's saying is that there is value and I created all people equal. And he's showing that maybe we've got some injustices wrong when we do that to people, men and women alike. I love that he appears to women. And secondly, it gives me confidence that this story is true. Because if I'm writing a story, if I'm one of the disciples and I'm trying to make this up so people believe it, if this isn't actually true, I'm not saying in that first century world he's appearing to women. That is a weak position to argue from, you know? If I'm making this up, I am telling them that they appeared to the biggest and the best person in the community. Just like I will tell my girl one day that I was all-state linebacker in football, you know? I will. I have no shame about it. Because this is before we recorded everything, because she has no proof, right? And then she'll outgrow me one day and be like, that could have been true. So I'd love that the Bible does this again and again and again. These little notes, these little nuances and nuggets prove to me it's truth, because you wouldn't write it this way if you were making it up. Not even close. And so Jesus appears to three women in this narrative, and Mary still doesn't quite understand. If you keep reading with me, it says that she didn't know it was Jesus. Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Who are you looking for?" Because she thought he was the gardener, she said to him, "Sir, if you've carried him away, tell me, and I will take him." We're going to come back to the gardener comment later, because that's just awkward. But I can't help but notice in this text, again, if our perception shapes our belief, and our belief then leads towards our action. Mary was there when Jesus died. Mary knew that he'd been put in the tomb. And what this story does for Mary is it completely, once again, as it has happened before as we followed Jesus, is this is a story where Jesus completely reshapes the perceptions of those who followed him. So she knew that Jesus was dead, and even though she's looking at him, nothing moved her off of that. Nothing moved her off of the fact that I saw him die, he can't be here, even if he's standing right here. It's funny how belief works that way. We can look at evidence and still believe something that goes against the evidence we're looking at. And so when Jesus says to Mary, "Who are you looking for?" it's a different question to me. I think when Jesus says to Mary, "Who are you looking for?" he's challenging what kind of Messiah, what kind of Savior, what kind of teacher he was in the first place. He's saying, what did you think was going to happen to me? What did you believe about me? I'm here. I'm here right now. She is challenging the kind of Savior that he said he was all along, because that fell away for her. And one of the most touching parts of the story, in verse 16, Jesus simply responds to her, "Mary." I absolutely love that it's just the first name. I think in my life, the people that I've known the most and that have known me the most can just say my name and I can know exactly what they mean. From when I was a kid, my mom could say my name, and I think we all have this experience, and I could know exactly how mad she was at me in the moment, the way she said my name. I could know if she was happy with me. That happened once or twice, right? And then fast forward with me and my wife, and my wife's gonna love that I'm comparing to my mom, but when my wife says my name, I know exactly what's going on when my wife says my name, and that took time. That didn't happen in week one of our marriage. My wife is easily excited, you could say. And so she'll drop something, and I really, the first time she yelled my name, anyway, I was in the other room, I really thought she was dying. Like, I thought somebody had stabbed her, but she had dropped like a Kleenex box, and that's fine. Now I know, oh, that's Sarah moderately, like, that's a Kleenex box, and oh, that's a pan, and she's covered in hot oil. Like, I get the difference now. Why? Because I know her. I know when she says my name what that means. One day, my future kid, I will know when they yell my name from the other room if this is I need to run towards them because they're hurting, or I need to ignore it like all good parents do sometimes, you know? I'll know the difference. I love in this moment that Jesus just looks at Mary and just said, he didn't say, "Hey, it's me, Jesus." Didn't say, "Hey, Mary, remember?" He just says, "Mary," and in that moment, she knew. I think it shows so many things about the character and the nature of God. I think it shows us that we are known by God intimately. I think it shows us, as the scriptures do in John 10, that Jesus calls us by name, not by number. I think it shows us that he wants to know you personally. I think it shows us that he wants a relationship with his followers, not just adherence to a certain moral code. I think it shows us the character and the nature of a God who knows his creatures, who knows his people well because we're made in his image. I think it shows value. And so he looks at Mary and he says, "Mary," and she responds. She turned to him and said in verse 16 in Aramaic, "Rabboni," which means teacher. That's what she called him before. One theologian, Tasker, says, "Never was there a one-word utterance more charged with emotion than this. It's the moment when Jesus took utter despair from Mary, and as she changed her perception of who he was, replaced it with joy. So in a moment, all that sadness was gone, and she was just overwhelmed with it all. And it says in the next verse that she literally clung to him and wouldn't let go like anybody would do. And so what we see with Mary as she's changing her perception of who Jesus is, as she's still continually learning, is the next verses kind of give a key to what's going on. Look at the end of verse 17 and 18. She says, hey, go and tell, I haven't ascended to my Father yet, so go tell my brothers, the other disciples, and tell them, I'm ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God. Mary Magdalene, verse 18, came and informed the disciples, I have seen the Lord. And she told them what he had said to her. I think first and foremost, what we see in this narrative through Mary's changed perspective is we see this idea that Jesus took away despair and hopelessness and he put in place of it joy and purpose. So he said, you're sad and you're weeping, but I'm here now and I came back from the dead, and instead now go and do these things. There's a writer that I follow. He's a good writer. He writes for the Gospel Coalition, and he said, so the point of the resurrection is not to sit back and wait for a heavenly afterlife. It's not to give a religious dimension to our lives. It's not to rest only on the comfort of future hope. The point of the resurrection is proclamation. And this is the story you see with Jesus with almost every group he meets with. It's not just, hey guys, I'm here, this is awesome. It's, hey guys, I'm here, go and tell everybody else. The resurrection in a moment gives purpose. The resurrection in a moment for these people on a very micro level took away pain and replaced it with purpose and said, now you have something to go and do. And that is a beautiful story. It does it with you and with me. As followers of Jesus, as we change our perception around the fact that he is not dead, but he is alive, it gives you and me purpose to go and tell. To go and tell other people that he's not in the ground anymore. And that's fantastic. So Mary gets this perception of Jesus, but I think she misses another one. Go back to verse 17 with me. She understands how the resurrection's affecting her right then and there, but I think she misses the bigger one. Verse 17, Jesus replied, "Do not touch me, for I have not ascended to my Father yet." I think when you first read this, it's a little harsh. She just replaced her sadness with incredible joy. She's thrilled that he's back, and she clings to Jesus, and he looks down. She's probably grabbing his legs because that's the position you took as a learner of a rabbi, grabs his legs and says, I'm so glad you're here. And he looks down and says, don't touch me. You're a little dirty, right? That seems really harsh to me in this moment. But the why comes later when he says, and we just read it, hey, I haven't done what I came to do yet. I'm going back to my Father. And really what you get with this verbiage, what you get with this word picture is, I have some friends of mine that are elementary school teachers. And the first day of school thing, when kiddos are terrified to walk into the classroom and they cling to the parents. I've seen it here sometimes, you know? It's like we're torturing children sometimes, the way they wail when you hand them off to our lovely childcare workers. It's the idea that I don't ever want to let you go. But what she missed was the bigger perception, was the bigger goal of what Jesus came to do. She was just right there and right then. She got that the resurrection gave her purpose, but she thought it probably only involved her. So go back to the gardener comment. I think this was one of my favorites as I was studying this text this week. I kept going back to it and asking why it was there, because I think this story tells us kind of the micro and the macro perception of what the resurrection affects, of how it changed our perceptions both in the here and now and in the future. So in the Bible, when we try and interpret the text, there's some different rules we do it by. So for example, we usually let the Bible interpret the Bible. So what that means is, if Paul uses a word, or if Luke uses a word, or John uses a word, and we don't quite know what he meant by it because it's given definition through context in the Greek, we usually go to another place that they used it. And we say, well, they used it over here and meant this, so it makes sense that they meant it over here, you know? It's like when you have teenagers and you don't know what language they're speaking anymore, and you're trying to figure out what they mean with words that you thought meant something else. And so one of the other ones that we use sometimes, not all the time, I think it applies here, it's called the principle of the first mention. And what I mean by that is the disciples and most Jewish boys and girls had memorized the first five books of the Old Testament. They knew it by heart. And there's this idea that when you hear a word or a phrase, you go back to the first time it's mentioned, and that first time gives clarity to this time. So let me give you an example. I do a lot of weddings, and I did one a couple weeks ago. And when I do weddings, I like to tell the truth. And so it's not just, let me read 1 Corinthians 13 and talk to you about how you're entering into the fairy tale of life. Right? When I do weddings, there's usually a part where I stop down and I very intentionally say, guys, it is really good right now, but it's not always going to be this way. And that's probably going to be your honeymoon, because we don't talk about it, but most people get in big fights on their honeymoon. And the people that laughed have. But seriously, and we stop down and we say, guys, it's going to be hard sometimes. And there's going to be some times when you do not like the person that you're beaming with joy looking at right now. And I say, but here's what today is. Today is a moment we remember, because when that moment comes in a day or 2 days or a month or a year, or if you want to lie to people, 2 years, right? When that day comes, think about right here, right now. Think about the vows you said to one another, how you felt about one another, the commitment that you meant when you said it. Think about right here, right now, and may that inform those moments when you don't like each other too much. It's kind of the same thing in the text. An example of how it's worked out is, if you go to, let's take, just because it's the Bible, let's take the idea of love, the word love. So again, all these Jewish boys had memorized the first five books of the Bible. Take John, for example. The first time we see the word love in the book of John is John 3:16. The coffee mug verse of all coffee mug verses. It's fantastic, right? For God so loved the world that he gave his only beloved son. Beautiful text. So I think what John does there, and it's a really interesting thought how it's done in the other gospels as well, is what he wants to do is say, hey, where was the first time we see love used in any of the Old Testament scriptures? And I was looking it up this week, and I was kind of surprised. The first time we see love used is Genesis 22. It doesn't make it into the story for 22 verses. And what we see in that story is the story of a guy named Abraham. He started the Jewish people. He didn't have kids for a long time, 80s and 90s. And it's a very scary thing in the first century world, because if you don't have kids, you literally don't have a future. But God promised him a future. So like probably many of us along our lives, we are in this middle tension of, I know God promised me things, but he's seemingly not delivering. Is God still good? And so finally, when they're in their 90s, they give birth to a kid. It's one son. It's only one son. It is all of their hope and all their future. And the first time we see the word love in the Bible is when God looks at Abraham and says, I want you to take the son, the one you love, and sacrifice him. This beautiful idea that's tagged in John 3:16, of I'm going to sacrifice my son. And that never happened because that was just a foreshadowing of Jesus. But I think when Jewish kids read John 3:16, they thought Abraham and they thought Genesis 22. So when she says, and this verse always struck me, when she says, when John says that Mary thought it was the gardener, I'm asking the question, why is that there? Like, why couldn't he just say, John just say, Mary thought it was someone else. Mary thought it was somebody around. Mary thought it was somebody else weeping. You know, literally the gardener. So I ask the question as I'm figuring it out, where's the first time we've seen the word garden? Genesis 1, 2, and 3. And that picture in Genesis 1, 2, and 3 is perfect. It's the way we were supposed to function in our world. It's the way everything was supposed to be before sin entered and messed it all up. Look, I think what John's alluding to here is that Jesus' resurrection absolutely came to bring purpose, but there's way more than just Mary here. I think what he's saying is literally that I came to bring back what was lost when sin entered the world. I think what he's saying is that the resurrection is more than just your purpose now. It's our hope for the future as God continues to save and points us towards one day when we'll be back there, our intended purpose again. N.T. Wright is a theologian, and he has a quote that I really like. He said, God alone will make the new heavens and new earth, yet this is not an excuse for inaction on our part. We have a responsibility as a resurrection people to work for the coming kingdom in the here and now. Scott McKnight, another author I like, says, resurrection is not an afterthought in the story of our salvation. It's the defining moment of our recreation. So in the resurrection, I absolutely think we see in the story God saying, I came to replace and fix and give purpose to hurt and pain right here, right now, but I'm doing something much, much bigger. And it's beautiful. I think he's saying, I came to restore and rebuild the world like I made it in the very first place. Now, here's why that matters. I think if I look at where we are as a people, if I look at where we are as probably a society overall, I think we're good with the second one. I think we wear blazers and come on Easter, and that's a beautiful thing. I think we check the box that says, yep, I'm still saved and going to heaven. And that's an amazing, amazing truth. I think when we think resurrection, we think heaven, and that is absolutely true. But I wonder if our perception of the resurrection is only shaped by the future hope and not the present reality that God brings life where there is death now. I wonder about that. Because I think both are happening in our text. And to only focus on the fact that the resurrection means one day I'm not going to go to hell is great, but what do we miss? What do we miss when we do that? What do we miss when we forget that the resurrection changes our perception and gives us purpose right here, right now, and informs our today just as much as our tomorrow? What do we miss when we do that? Because over and over again, after this happens, we see the disciples and we see Mary and we see the family of God crying out saying that something out there is better, not just because God wants us to live a better life so he looks better, but because Jesus beat death. The resurrection is more than just our hope for tomorrow. It is our purpose today as we yell that there is life. The resurrection doesn't just impact us after we die, but it changes how we live today, because as we change our perception of Jesus, our thoughts and actions follow. It's kind of like I was talking to Andy this week about this text and what it meant. And he said that, you know, it's kind of like adoption. It's a good analogy. I have some friends that have adopted kids, and it'd be really sad if you adopted kids and they said, hey, thanks for adopting me. I'm so happy and I'm so excited. And especially now, because there's a movement to adopt from third world countries, man, that's great. When you guys die, I'm going to get a great inheritance. Instead of saying, hey, I want to come live with you and live into the rhythms of your family life now because it's better. So that's what sometimes we do, I think, as Christians, is we look at the resurrection and say, man, it's going to be great one day, and we don't say, how is it great today? I think the resurrection in every single way is all about God saying there is life right here and there's life right now, and because I rose again, live into it. Triven Wax also said, the resurrection is not the happy end after Jesus' death. It's the happy beginning of God's new creation. We have a job to do. So the resurrection changes our perspective. It gives us purpose for today, knowing we have hope for tomorrow. It's this beautiful message of Jesus coming and saying that there will be a resurrection, but I also came to proclaim my goodness today, to give life today. It's one that we find on the pages of Scripture over and over and over again, that the resurrection isn't just our hope for when we die, but it's the reason why our marriages have hope. It's the reason why when I live out my marriage well, I'm not just living out a good way to live, I'm living out the hope that Jesus says there's life here where maybe there would be death. It's the hope that I'm going to be a good dad and pass on the tradition of life, not because God said so and I don't know why, but because Jesus rose from the dead. And in that resurrection, I can breathe the life of Jesus into my family and into my children and into my work and into my church and into my community. So when people look at me and they say, why is this happening? I can look at them and say, because Jesus rose and death is done. There is life where there was death. And it doesn't just impact my tomorrow. It impacts my today. That's the beauty of the resurrection. And it leaves us to this place where we look at God. And once again, as our perceptions change, we are in awe. And we start believing that he's doing something in this space, not just will do something in the one later. And we live into it. It's this beautiful truth that God's not done with the world yet, but he proclaims his hope and his life as we live into the power of his son's death and resurrection today. It's gorgeous. And what would it look like if we did that all the time?